This is an ABC podcast.
When oligarchs and other politically connected criminals, people who can steal from the state, amass their wealth, they need to get it out of their home countries. They need to get it somewhere secure, somewhere it will grow, somewhere like the US or France or Australia. And to do that, they need help.
So you need real estate agents, you need auditors, you need lawyers, of course, you need bankers, you need people who run big hedge funds and private equity funds, you need art dealers, because the art market is rife with all sort of dirty cash and there are almost no restrictions on it.
That's Frank Vogel. His collective term for all these people is the enablers. You'll hear more about them later. Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Adie. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has given his fiscal statement to Parliament. Short version, things are bad, worse than we thought. Inflation's expected to get to 7.75% by the end of the year before slowly coming down over the next 2 years. In the meantime, slower economic growth and unemployment starting to climb again from next year. Danielle Woods, the Chief Executive at the Grattan Institute. Danielle, what's the worst part of Jim Chalmers' statement?
Well, there was certainly some pretty sobering news on the inflation front. For those that might be hoping that the cost of living pressures were going to start to ease, it was unfortunately not good news in the statement. The Treasurer suggested that the worst is yet to come, that we will expect to see inflation peak at 7.75% later this year. People will remember the latest June update was at 6.1%. So we've still got a bit of a way to go in the inflation journey. And even though it's then forecast to sort of normalise and then start to moderate, the numbers in the statement today have that happening over several years. So prices are going to be higher for longer than any of us would have expected or hoped.
Yeah, and there's also going to be an effect on growth, isn't there? Although that's something you probably don't feel at the household level quite so much.
That's right. So the numbers today suggest that the growth rate for last financial year, for the current financial year and for the next financial year will be lower than Treasury had forecast. The way that's felt at a household level is slower wages growth overall, and the wages, the real wage numbers have come down and nominal wages are going up as prices go up, and a little bit more unemployment than we'd forecast back in March, although unemployment levels, you know, still very low by historical standards.
Yeah, and I think that uptick is not projected to begin until next year. He didn't really talk about higher interest rates, but of course we are going to have to see higher interest rates, aren't we?
Look, that's right. I think, you know, the Reserve Bank has used the language on the along the lines of whatever it takes, and very clearly they want to see these inflation rates come down. They're very nervous of inflation staying high and the risks of that becoming entrenched. If expectations start to shift and we all anticipate inflation will stay higher, you know, that factors into wage claims and you can end up in the so-called wage price spiral. So, you know, when Reserve Bank is responding to these inflation rates across the economy, we will absolutely expect them to see them move higher on rates, I think probably as soon as next week, with, you know, potentially a number of more moves throughout the year.
Well, the RBA has sort of been signalling that already. Actually, somebody asked me about this the other day, and I think part of the RBA's difficulty is that it is trying to do what it can by squashing demand, but really all of the inflationary pressure, just about, has been coming from the supply side.
That's right. And look, there is a demand element to this, and the Reserve Bank has been clear about that. We are seeing capacity constraints in the economy because of high levels of consumer spending, you know, off the back of, you know, some pretty substantial fiscal and monetary supports during COVID. So there has been a demand side element, and certainly the Reserve Bank's actions will help with that. But there is a lot that is just outside the control of the Reserve Bank and the government. These are the kind of external shock factors, the war in Ukraine, supply chain issues, particularly coming out of China. Reserve Bank interest rates do nothing to moderate those. And I think, you know, when we look at the inflation outlook that's contained in this statement, it's probably the numbers they're picking are in the middle of two very different scenarios. So one is if those external factors work their way through the system, start to calm down, we could see inflation come back to low levels very quickly. On the other hand, if they persist over a number of years, we could be looking at significantly higher inflation regardless of what the Reserve Bank does.
Some of those external factors already look like they might be coming down, he says, perhaps somewhat optimistically.
Yeah, that look, there's certainly some promising signs, but, you know, these are the things that make forecasting hard. And, you know, there are so many moving pieces at the moment that it's very difficult to work out where things might land.
So Jim Chalmers is saying the government will act to ease some cost of living pressure and specifically childcare and medicines.
That's right. So, I mean, these are both policies that the government took to the last election. They will help with some items in the household budget for those families that have children in care. Childcare is actually quite a substantial cost, so anything that brings that down will provide some cost of living relief. And ditto with the cost of medicines on the PBS. That will help people that are using or heavy users of prescription medicines. So all of those things help. They're not, of course, across the board relief, but they do help some groups that would be feeling the squeeze right now.
Yeah, they really target young families and also older people, I thought. Any surprises, anything of note, Danielle?
Look, there wasn't a huge amount that was new in there, Richard, I think it's fair to say, and certainly a lot of the sort of broad policy themes are consistent with the themes that Labor were talking about during the election. One thing that the Treasurer did slip in was that the fiscal result for last financial year will be better than forecast, and that's off the back of things like higher commodity prices. I think he was very much managing that message. You know, don't think that will continue. So we will have a good budget number, followed by some, you know, I think some pretty challenging budget numbers. And you know, really what he was trying to say is, you know, don't get your hopes up for the October budget and for the March budget that follows. We are entering a fairly challenging period for fiscal policy.
Yeah, but if the economy does start to come right in, say, 2 years, I'm thinking politically rather than economically here, that might work out quite well for the government.
Well, indeed. Look, there may well be a sense of relief. I mean, so I think the strong theme out of the statement today is we are in for a bumpy couple of years, both in terms of inflation and then the flow-on impacts of that for global and Australian growth. If we do see things start to turn around pre 2025 election, indeed, I think we know that economic conditions and the economy is an important factor in the way people vote.
Absolutely. I know it's a busy day for you, Danielle. Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Danielle Wood from the Grattan Institute. You probably heard that Indonesia's trying to deal with an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. This is already affecting the market for Australian cattle there, but the nightmare for Australian producers would be the disease getting in here. Susie Hester's at the University of New England. She's also chief investigator at the Centre for Excellence for Biosecurity Risk Analysis in the University of Melbourne. Susie, how much could this cost us?
The figure that your readers will be hearing a lot is $80 billion over 10 years. This figure comes from one of the outbreak scenarios that was modelled 5 or 6 years ago by the Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resource Economics and Sciences, ABARES. So in 2013, they evaluated the potential economic impacts of three scenarios, and for each scenario, various control strategies. And the scenario that the $80 billion figure comes from is the worst case scenario, I guess, the large multi-state outbreak.
Let's walk through that, because with any economic modelling, there's always assumptions. What are the key ones for this figure?
Okay, so with this large outbreak, it was assumed that the first detection or the event started in Victoria, and that by the time it was detected, it had spread to all of the eastern states. So time to detection is hugely important. The various eradication strategies that were used involved some level of destruction of animal carcasses and some vaccination. There's an assumption about time to eradication, and the modelling of this large-scale outbreak suggested that would be 5 months with the stamping out strategy.
Yeah.
There were also assumptions about time to regain markets, and this was reasonably slow.
That is, as I understand it, where a lot of these costs come from, how long you're out of a market for. What are we looking at by year 10?
Well, look, it varies according to the product. It's thought for beef exports that they won't have fully recovered by year 10. They'll still only be around 80% of their pre-FMD outbreak level. Pork will be 87% of its pre-FMD level. Sheep meat will be a little bit better at 92%.
Now, forgive me if this is a very naive question. Why would it take so long to recover those markets? If you're saying, look, the modelling assumed we're able to extinguish this disease in under 6 months, but 10 years later we still haven't got everything back.
Yes, so the slow recovery is because for some products, our exports will actually be replaced by exports from other countries. And that's particularly the case for beef. It is also a little bit unknown about how soon markets will be open up to us.
Right. What about other losses? Would it affect wool, for example?
Yes. It will affect all of those products and animals that are from the cloven-hoofed families. But because we're the dominant supplier of wool in the world, it should be a much quicker process to get our wool back into export markets following eradication of foot and mouth disease, and assuming that the international trading community is happy that we've satisfied all of the international requirements for foot and mouth disease free status.
So how much would it cost us in wool? Did the ABARES model have a number there?
Yes, Richard, it's $1.69 billion.
Right. What about dairy? That would be affected too, I'm guessing.
Yes, certainly. So dairy is $6.5 billion. That's the losses, and they're the updated figures for dairy.
Right. What I've noticed, though, is that they don't really consider any other effects. So like tourism, and, of course, people like to go to places where farming also overlaps. What do we know about the extent that tourism would be affected?
Yes, that's right, Richard. This ABARES modelling is really just on impacts to producers and the costs of responding. They note other impacts, and we certainly know what other impacts are, and they do include impacts on the tourism industry. Hmm. For a while, no one will be able to visit the regions if we had an outbreak. There'd be movement controls, and it's unclear how long these would last.
Hmm. Now, the other one could be mental health. If you're a farmer and you have to cull your herd, that's more than an economic loss to you, isn't it?
Oh, yes, certainly. And again, the ABARES report noted the mental health impacts and discusses them in detail. They're really horrible. They include the distressed calls to farmers from all of those things such as loss of control, animal welfare concerns, you know, watching animals be culled, uncertainty about when the outbreak will end and what it's going to do to their income, social issues about social isolation. I mean, there will be a time where you can't interact in communities. But look, we shouldn't forget that there'll be mental health impacts on any frontline workers involved in the eradication attempt, and that includes vets. There's a lot of distress. Mm. It continues beyond eradication through time, and it's also experienced well beyond the farming community.
Now, obviously prevention's better than cure, which is where biosecurity comes in. What does it cost to have the level of biosecurity that we have in Australia?
Having a biosecurity system as comprehensive as ours in Australia isn't cheap. The government spends not quite $1 billion on the biosecurity system, and that has elements of pre-border activities, border activities that we're all becoming very familiar with, and post-border. So colleagues at SEBRA, where I work, have estimated that the value of the biosecurity system is around $314 billion if you took it over 50 years.
Is that what it is saving us, having it?
Yes. This is the net value of the damages we avoid by having our biosecurity system. And there's a particular study that I was looking at earlier from SEBRA, and it calculates a return on investment of 30 to 1 in our biosecurity investments.
Mm. And even in these COVID times, when we've all become a bit more used to these very large numbers, that is a very large number.
Yes.
So, Susie, yes. You said government, but is that all government outlay, or do other people pay too?
Look, that is only the outlay from a federal government Department of Agriculture, and they have large expenditures in the pre-border and border space, but also post-border. We have farmers who spend money on farm biosecurity. Industry spends a significant amount of money on research and technology development. The environmental sector can be affected by biosecurity incursions. So really everyone has a responsibility in this space, but there are many, many stakeholders investing a lot of money.
Right. What about the importers? Because you would think if you make it their cost, this is a highly motivating factor.
Yes, but this is not currently the way that we fund biosecurity, Richard. And look, it's a new area of research that I'm personally have an interest in. But basically, the costs of biosecurity are really borne by those affected by it. We haven't yet implemented a way of getting the risk creators to pay, but I think that that's coming. With the increases in trade and tourism, we really are going to be hard-pressed to fund all of the biosecurity activities we need to fund. And you might know that our Agricultural Minister, Murray Watt, is calling for a sustainable biosecurity funding model, and I guess we're working on that.
Right. Now, I suspect this would be a very long list, so just give us a quick summation. What else does all that biosecurity, $1 billion a year plus extra, prevent from getting here?
Well, Richard, a huge amount of things, absolutely huge. It helps us keep out almost 400 plant pests that we don't have in Australia, ranging from slugs to other bugs, a whole swag, probably around 50 notifiable animal diseases, some of which you and your listeners will have heard of: African swine fever, lumpy skin disease, equine influenza and rabies, to name a few. We shouldn't forget about all the aquatic marine diseases that we haven't yet got, that we keep out, a number of marine pests and a whole host of weeds as well. So there's a lot of stuff.
Well, that's a good place to wrap things up. Susie, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
It's a pleasure, Richard.
Susie Hester, who's at the University of New England, and SEBRA, the Centre of Excellence for Biosecurity Risk Analysis. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has highlighted the oligarchs, many of whom have vast assets in the West, Europe and North America especially. Those assets have bought political connections, which is why Frank Vogel, longtime documenter of and campaigner against corruption, says they're a threat to democracy. He unpacks this idea in his book, The Enablers. Frank, how much money are we talking about?
There's something like $2 trillion US dollars of dirty money, money that has been stolen by government officials from their citizens, money that has been the product of transnational organized crime, circulates through the financial system every year.
That's a staggering figure, isn't it? And we'll get to the role of the financial industry in this. But you actually unpack a few of the other industries that are involved as well. Let's just briefly walk through a few.
Well, it's very important to understand that if you are Vladimir Putin, or you are associates of Xi Jinping in China, and you have had access to public funds that you happen to have stolen, you need to have people in the Western markets, capital markets, who can help you to essentially acquire investments safely and secretly, because you want to get the money out of your country. So you need real estate agents, you need auditors, you need lawyers, of course, because they're vital in helping make sure the investments are secret. You need bankers, you need very often people who run big hedge funds and private equity funds and who are financial consultants. You need art dealers, because the art market is rife with all sort of dirty cash and there are almost no restrictions on it. And as we've seen recently, as Western governments have gone after some of Russia's oligarchs, you also need people who trade and sell super yachts and other wonderful, expensive luxuries.
Well, let's walk through a few of the examples. You write that about 40 banks in the West have assets of $1 trillion or more. They're very powerful. After the 2008 financial crisis, there were many reports about the need for cultural change starting at the top. And yet, we're still witnessing corruption at this level. And there's a fascinating example that I'd like you to briefly talk about, that Goldman Sachs and their dealings with the former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. Just quickly, the bare bones of what happened there.
Goldman Sachs, based in Wall Street, is one of the most powerful banks in the world. About 10 years ago, a little more than that, officials at Goldman Sachs running some of its Asian operations paid bribes in Malaysia and elsewhere to get into business with, amongst others, the government of Malaysia. The government of Malaysia then commissioned Goldman Sachs to issue bonds, $6 billion of bonds on behalf of the Development Aid Agency of Malaysia to help poor people in Malaysia. It was called 1MDB. Goldman Sachs charged $6.5 billion. In other words, it took already $500 million in commissions. Of the $6 billion of bonds that should have gone out to international investors, possibly $4.5 billion was stolen. It was stolen because executives at Goldman Sachs, working with the former Prime Minister of Malaysia and working with a whole bunch of his associates to loot the poor people of Malaysia, because Malaysia still has to pay that money back. It is one of the largest money laundering corruption schemes ever perpetrated. Goldman Sachs was fined more than $3.5 billion, and the total amount, actually, if they can't get back some of the stolen loot, may be even more than that. The former Prime Minister of Malaysia has been sentenced to 12 years in prison. And what about the top executives of Goldman Sachs? Nobody prosecuted them. Nobody has taken them to jail or even taken them to court. They probably wrote off the cost of the fines, just another cost of doing business. So when you look at these big banks and you look at the big real estate companies and the auditors and all the rest of it, all they care about at the top are short-term profits, because short-term profits increase the value of the shares in the marketplace, and the value of the shares determines the size of their bonuses. And that's the whole name of the game.
When you are as big as Goldman Sachs, is part of the issue for Western authorities that these banks, these concerns are too big to prosecute effectively, or too big to fail, in fact, that we can't do it because there will be so much downside for everybody else?
You know, a member of the United States Congress at one point asked the Attorney General of the United States, are these banks not only too big to fail, but too big to jail? And essentially, that is the view that continues and continues. But I don't see why we could not have laws that make the top executives of these banks personally liable when their institution has been found to repeatedly commit these kinds of crimes. Because one of the big tragedies here is that it's the same banks, time and time and time again, that are caught manipulating financial markets, perpetrating fraud on their own customers, laundering money, engaging in corruption. And yet the top executives are never prosecuted. In fact, they're wined and dined at the White House and 10 Downing Street and everywhere where, because of their financial power, they have access.
I want to touch briefly on arms deals, which I always think is about the dodgiest legal industry going. Are they also part of the enablers?
Indirectly, almost every major international arms deal involves kickbacks and bribes paid to government officials in order for companies to win very big contracts. That's the corruption side. But then comes the question, well, okay, now these officials have got these big kickbacks. What do they do with them? And this is where the money laundering comes in. Because like all other deals that where they get kickbacks, be it on pharmaceuticals, being bribed to turn a blind eye to what comes through customs in their countries, they still want to get the loot that they've stolen out of their country into the world's biggest capital markets, where it's safest and where they can earn the biggest rate of return.
Frank, to kind of end this, if we could stop it, I suppose you can go to the root, to the authoritarian regimes themselves, the autocrats, the oligarchs. People have tried. Mostly it hasn't worked. Or you can disable the enablers. Is that the easier thing to do? Because that, it's sort of in the system.
I don't really think it's an and-or proposition. I think we really have to do both. But what is very clear is that it's up to our own national governments, be it Australia, be it the United States, the UK, to deal with the enablers, because they live on our shores. They are bringing this dirty money into our countries, our markets. And you have to ask yourself, why haven't we done more about them? Because after all, it shouldn't be too difficult. Well, one of the reasons is that the financial communities in many countries are enormously well connected politically. Mm-hmm. And they've used those connections to make sure that the regulation of the financial system is far weaker than it should be. So that's the lobbying. That's the influence that the enablers have. And we have to recognize that. Second of all, on recognizing that, we have to understand that over the years, actions to enforce money laundering and anti-corruption laws have been very, very timid. A couple of years ago, Westpac of Australia was caught in a scandal involving very large amount of money laundering.
I remember.
And it paid a fine in excess of $1 billion, a very big fine, I think the largest in Australia's history. The question is, this was a money laundering scandal with many, many accounts that apparently had been going on for quite a long time. And you had to ask yourself, why hadn't the banking regulators found this earlier? And the truth is, in Australia, in the UK, in Europe, in the United States, banking regulatory authorities are underfunded. We have not, in national budgets, given enough money to law enforcement to really move on this front, to the point where the head of the British Serious Crime Squad publicly said, we do not have the money to really take on the Russian oligarchs who are in the UK, in London, and who have turned the property market of London into what people now call Londongrad. So we can do a lot about this. We must do a lot about it, but we must do it because it affects our security, as Russia's invasion of Ukraine underscores. Perhaps we must do it because it's about our democracy.
That perhaps is the most powerful way to frame it. Frank, it is a fascinating, disconcerting, alarming read, but it's very, very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us today here on The Money.
Well, thank you.
Frank Vogel is the author of The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption Endangering Our Democracy. That is it for The Money. Huge thanks to producer Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.